I want to welcome everyone to session 251, Responses to the Documentary 8, The Moral Proposition. My name is Hugo Olayas. I'm the news editor for Sandston Magazine. As you know, Sandston is a foundation, it's a non-profit, and we survive because of the contributions of people like you. I want to remind everyone that access to this session is either by ticket or by badge. And we invite all of you to be generous in your support of the Sandston Foundation. I have two friends with me in this panel who are very well known. Laura Compton, who is helping here set up the system, is a same-sex marriage supporter whose views have been featured by the Associated Press and KUED. She was the organizer of a recent vigil marking the 10-year anniversary of Stuart Mann's suicide, and she blogs at mormonsformarriage.com. Robert Weiss, sitting here to my left, is the author of No More Strangers and Foreigners, A Christian Mormon Response to Homosexuality, and the co-author of A Guide for LDS Families Dealing with Homosexuality. Robert is very well known in the Sandston and in the dialogue communities because of his many years of contributions as an editor, a writer, and a board member. Laura. Do you think, should we wait a couple of minutes till this is ready? We wanted to start with a few clips. The clips are going to take about 10 minutes. And by way of explanation, we call this a panel. We have only two panelists. The reason being that they didn't have enough 1.5 hour slots for... So we wanted to keep it short in such a way that there will be at least a few minutes for Q&A at the end. So that is why there are many wonderful people who are blogging about this movie. As you may know, it has been quite controversial, even among gay Mormons who don't necessarily think that the movie is the best. So we wanted to keep it short so that you would be able to have a chance to ask at least a few questions. Laura has chosen a collection of clips trying to give you a sense of what the movie is, and they are going to run for about 10 minutes. How many of you have already seen the movie? Oh, okay. What's that? Great.
Psychological thing, the connection I felt with Tyler was something I had never felt before, and it took me, you know, 2 weeks to be like, you know, this is love. I've never felt this before. The Supreme Court decision had come down and suddenly marriage was a possibility. And so we went down to Big Sur on the Central California coast and I got a ring and I proposed and he said, yes.
On the first day, gay couples could get married in California. Hundreds made their way to city halls to make their dream of marriage a reality.
What better day to get married than this first historic day? But we did not know what we were in for. Immediately, we saw all these news trucks and the helicopters and people outside.
Lisa Tyler called me at 7 o'clock in the morning, said, Mom, we have our suits on, we're going down to City Hall to see if we can get a license. We couldn't get an appointment, they were all taken out, but we're just going to stand in line and see if we can get in.
One guy at the door, he was like, okay, you don't have an appointment, but just under like, man. And then I kind of looked down at this clipboard, and as I'm writing, I walked behind my back. So he's got to get into the car, I'm in the City Hall.
And he called me every 20 minutes. Mom, by the door. And then he calls and says, we're getting married. And I'm freaking out because I'm not there. And he's like, wait, I'm not there. No, don't wait to do it.
We went up to the Central Rotunda in beautiful San Francisco City Hall.
The parking lot was fast, looking over our shoulder.
And it was so perfect and magical.
You, Spencer, and Tyler have given and pledged your love and faithfulness to the other. I am declared the same by joining hands by virtue of the authority vested in me as Deputy Marriage Commissioner by the State of California. I now pronounce you partners in life.
In the moment, as we felt the enormity of what we were doing, making that real, solid, and recognized commitment to each other that is like no other commitment two people can make, and getting a license that says marriage certificate, and, you know, the stamp of the State of California on that, we could have made it on our own, and plenty of gay couples do make it on their own, but it's such a struggle, and it's hard, and, you know, it's hard for straight couples, right? So having that certificate suddenly makes it a little bit easier.
This was a good day for thousands of people in love. Marriage for all, and equal rights for all.
It feels so great to live in the city and in this state. On this day when history is being made, and I can't believe that I get to be a part of it, and I get to marry my partner of 6 years, and still all of this emotion, it's huge.
Everything changed when they got married, and I don't think people understand that. You know, why can't they just have a civil union or have this? It's different when you get married. That commitment level changes. Their relationship went to a totally new level. I can't even describe it.
But their happiness would not last long. Forces were already conspiring to take it all away.
And before the champagne was even warm from those celebrations, we were defending that victory and those marriages at the ballot box.
Fred Carter has investigated this war by following the money and the minimum.
Speaking, and it it says, get your checkbooks out.
I was in church when the fire was spread. And I kind of looked around, and you know, the energy began to accumulate, and this has to be done now. It was a surprise. Yeah, the fire was indeed stoked.
With a July opinion poll showing Meade could lose, Mormon leaders put out a call to Mormons in California. A message from their prophet beamed in Salt Lake City. Mormons only released 4 minutes of the broadcast on their website, but now audio from the entire one-hour broadcast has been uncovered.
You are a mighty man. You are responsible for holding true to the doctrine of the church. Indeed, we have been held by doctrine to speak out.
And when the word comes down from the Mormon prophet, it's not just a simple request. It's a commandment.
Mormons believe that their prophet literally is in communication with God, that Jesus Christ appears to their leaders in the Salt Lake Temple. So a call from their prophet is a call from God. It makes no difference in the Mormon mind. It takes a very brave spirit to say, I do not feel that that came from God.
We ask that you do all you can to support the proposed constitutional amendment by donating of your means and time to preserve the sacred institution of marriage.
Means and time is part of a vow ceremony that Mormons perform in the temple, where we promise to give of our means and our time to defend the church and to forward its mission. And we're told that we will lose our eternal salvation if we don't keep that promise. So when Mormons heard means and time, their prophet's call, it was like hope. It was, they got the message. It dramatized more than I have ever seen it dramatized before. The fear that I think is based on.
The faith of sin today often wears the mask of silence. Do not be deceived. Behind the facade is heartache, anger, and pain.
Nothing is going to come of this effort but sorrow for everybody. It is going to be the most divisive thing you have seen between families, between friends.
Shunning the train, the utilization of so-called sex marriage is a civil right. This is not a matter of civil rights. It is a matter of morality. These are general principles upon which the core doctrines of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ is based, and are part of our Heavenly Father's living eternal plan.
Gays interrupt the Mormon plan for heaven. And so taking away a sense of humanity or rights that they may deserve or demand is just collateral damage in pursuit of what Mormons believe is critical to their beliefs.
To understand the Mormon Church's war against gay marriage, it helps to understand the type of heaven Mormons hope to get to. Mormons teach that their Heavenly Father was once a human being. And when he died, he became God, where he began marrying spirit wives and having spirit offspring. Mormons believe before we were born on earth, we were born spiritually to a Heavenly Father and one of his many wives. Mormons believe that our lives on earth are a test. If we become Mormon, and if men and women marry in a Mormon temple, Mormons believe we too can become gods, on our own planets, filled with our own spirit wives and children. This is the Mormon plan for heaven. So when a gay child enters the picture, who can't have children biologically, and doesn't want to marry someone of the opposite sex, it not only upsets the Mormon definition of the family, but disturbs the entire Mormon concept of the afterlife.
Hell, hell, hell on earth, hell on earth.
it was just too much. Far too much for far too long. The fight to strip rights from anyone whose life is contrary to their heavenly plan. Too much to summon for tens of thousands, gay and straight, all over the country.
You know, we're not asking to know your mark of words, but I'm not going to have them bar the doors to City Hall.
What people justify the name of religion because it's their religion.
And yeah, they're like, we need to protect families, but what about our family?
When history is clear enough and we really see the damage that we have done, we should leave. And we will. We will be.
When you suffer the kind of subjugation that we have, let's do it. The collapse of unity robs us of our humanity. And the question is, how do we get it back? We have to, in effect, go to those who have damaged us and say, King, you owe me my dignity and my self-respect. And you need to, in effect, embrace my soul and tell me that I'm a whole human being. Because I am.
And the fight returned to where the campaign started. Salt Lake City, Utah. There, in the shadow of the Mormon temple, 5,000 people declared enough.
We are seeing a repeat of a tragic and deplorable history. We will celebrate full-fledged equality someday.
This is just because you are about two people who have chosen to spend the rest of their lives together. I just want people to get that this is simple. This is just love.
Maybe President Kimball was right. So, who's speaking first?
Bob.
What would you like? You're kind of power.
If, as Napoleon remarked, history is a fable agreed upon, and one might postulate that a documentary film is a fable not agreed upon. As someone who has written, produced, and directed one documentary and produced another one, I'm aware that the documentarian begins from a different place than the historian. Generally, his objective is not to attempt a complete or accurate or dispassionate narrative of a subject or particular circumstance, but rather to arrange the materials at his disposal so as to make a particular argument. This isn't to disparage documentary films, only to make clear that many such films might fit into the category we call polemics. Polemics is, quote, a form of dispute, wherein the main efforts of the disputing parties are aimed at establishing the superiority of their own points of view regarding an issue. Polemic is derived from the Greek word polemikos, meaning warlike or hostile. No doubt church leaders and the majority of Mormons would regard 8, the Mormon proposition, in this light. However, it is possible that the filmmakers considered another definition of polemics as more reflective of their intentions. Polemics is the branch of Christian theology devoted to the refutation of error. I guess, is that A, the Mormon proposition, lies somewhere in between these two definitions. The documentary filmmaker does not have a full palette of colors with which to paint his picture. Often he has to use colors others have chosen, which he may consider not quite right for his purposes, but nevertheless useful. While he may wish for documents, images, and symbols not at his disposal, if he is lucky, particular elements he didn't count on may fall into his lap, as with the case of the leaked documents from the Church's involvement in the Dome initiatives in Hawaii and California. Sometimes the filmmaker starts out to paint one picture and actually ends up painting another. I understand that Reed Cohen started out to make a film about homeless gay Latter-day Saint youth in Salt Lake City, but switched to Proposition 8 because it was more topical. A documentary film is almost always a piece of propaganda. That is certainly the case with 8, the Mormon Proposition. However, propaganda is also a term appropriate for much of the rhetoric, literature, and commercials produced by the proponents of Proposition 8. From the time the First Presidency Letter was read at the Sacrament Meeting 2 years ago until November 4th, 2009 and beyond, my essential mood has been one of sadness. Like some California Latter-day Saints, I fear that the aggressive campaign launched by the Yes on 8 coalition, but fueled prominently by the Mormon Church, had the potential both to alienate many citizens who might otherwise be favorably disposed toward the Church, and also to divide California Saints. My op-ed piece published in the Salt Lake Tribune the weekend of the First Presidency's letter was read at sacrament meetings throughout California, expressed my hope that with regard to Proposition 8, the Church would follow its long-established practice regarding political matters, as articulated by the First Presidency in 1903. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints holds to the doctrine of the separation of church and state, the non-interference of church authority in political matters, and the absolute freedom and independence of the individual in the performance of his political duties. If at any time there has been conduct at variance with this doctrine, it has been in violation of the well-settled principles and policies of the Church. I also cited the following statements from the First Presidency during the 1960s. Great civil rights era of our country. We call upon all men everywhere, both within and outside the Church, to commit themselves to the establishment of full civil equality for all of God's children. And each citizen must have equal opportunities and protection under the law with reference to civil rights. I first saw the 8th of the Mormon Proposition this spring, at one of its first showings at the Santa Cruz Film Festival. Given the general image of the Church and the saints in Santa Cruz, I expected, when I went to the theater, that there would be a rather hostile and unruly crowd. But in fact, the packed audience in the Riverfront Stadium, Riverfront Theater, were respectful and civil during both the showing of the film and in the discussion that followed. In that discussion, Spencer Jones, Tyler Barrick, and Tyler's mother, I think Tyler's mother's Linda, were in the audience, as well as a number of other people who were involved in the participant in making the film. It was, to me, also very gratifying that those people who were involved in making the film were not angry or bitter, full of vituperation, or it seems to me anything but kind and forgiving, and I felt very understanding in the presentation of their own experience. Those of you who just seen some of these clips, I think, would agree that there are, as there are with most documentary films, strengths and weaknesses. The strength of the film, the primary strength of the film, is that it shows the genuine love between two human beings in a way that captures what I think is in the heart of every love story, which is somehow craziness and intense devotion and great happiness, and at times also great sorrow, as happened in this case when the marriage that Tyler and Spencer entered into was for a period of time invalidated. That is, once Proposition 8 passed, the 18,000 people who had been married before the Proposition 8 passed didn't know whether or not their marriages were going to be invalidated or not. Let me just say a word about what I think some of the weaknesses of the film are, and how if I had been making the documentary, I might have done things differently. If the objective of the filmmakers was to show that the Mormon Church had been engaged in using misinformation, deception, stereotypes, and propagandistic methods in its support or in its campaign to support Proposition 8, then it seems to me that the filmmakers weakened their case by using many of these same tactics in presenting the story of Proposition 8. For example, the sensationalist use of the 1940s film material on the lobotomy. Part of the problem is that that's not presented in the context in which, as we now know, many lobotomies were performed. As the light of the families, the Kennedys had their daughter lobotomized. It was the consensus of the American Psychological Association and others that lobotomies were one of the ways to deal with people who had severe, what was considered severe, emotional disturbances, of which homosexuality was categorized as that. Those were terrific, terrifically unfortunate things that happened. No one can feel good about them. But we need a context in which to understand that, that those happen. One person leaving the showing of the film overheard someone say, "I can't believe they gave lobotomies to gay people so they could become Mormons." One might suggest that there are also non-surgical lobotomies that could be performed and had been. I think the use of statistics is always problematic, mainly because most of us don't know what numbers mean. I heard the NPR the other day, they were saying that anytime you want to get people's attention, you say 50,000. 50,000 people die every year from anything. And most of us say, yeah, isn't that terrible? I thought, you know, one of it was unfortunate that many members of the church in California were not coerced, I don't think, and maybe even not put pressure on, but were certainly strongly urged to make financial contributions. I think the example they tell, which is anecdotal, of someone whose bishop came to them and said, "I can see all the tithing you pay, this is how much you're supposed to pay," that seems to be absolutely fallacious. I just can't believe if it happened once, it would surprise him. But to use that as an example of how funds were raised. You know, in any story which is being told, tomorrow we'll be talking about Glenn Beck, and one of the tactics that Glenn Beck does is to haul out all of the worst examples of people in history and then somehow put a picture of Mao and Hitler and Mao Zedong and Che Guevara and then Obama up on the same blackboard. In a film in which you have Chris Butters and Gail Ruzicka as the kind of people speaking for you know, that side, it seems to me, it would have been nice to have had some more sensible, more moderate voices, perhaps people who weren't so easily dismissed and so easily stereotyped. The view of Mormonism in the film is not, it seems to me, one that that I would accept based on my familiarity with the church. I sometimes, in fact, I'm getting ready to teach a course on Mormonism at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley next month. And one of the things that I have been reading is Terrell Gibbons' book, The Viper and the Hearth, in which Terrell Gibbons does a wonderful job of documenting the anti-Mormon sentiment in America. It is the most vicious and most persistent anti-religious sentiment in this country. And it still continues. So I'm not happy with anything that feeds that. I'm happy for anything that is true and that is accurate, that helps people understand the real complexion and character of the church. I'm not happy when those things become so distorted as to be unrecognizable from the church that I belong to. Closing with, so I can turn time over to Laura. I think in some ways the most disturbing and deeply affecting part of the film was when one of the young men who was involved in this relationship, his grandfather, I think it was, said, "We refuse to find any joy or happiness in what you have done. One must have a heart of winter to have such a sentiment, whether you agree with it, what had happened or not, to see the joy and the happiness of these young people who are good and sensible people, and not to take any joy or gladness." I understand the sentiment, but it seems to me it's too cramped for my mind. James Baldwin wrote a letter to his nephew about race relationships. He said something really significant, which is an echo, perhaps, of what Trevor said, where he says, "You need to come and ask our forgiveness and give us our dignity." I don't think anybody can give us our dignity. But I think when we have it, it teaches us something about how we respond, even in the face of great injustice and wrong. And James Baldwin said to his nephew, telling him about the history of race relationships, he said, "The terrible news is, old buddy, that you and I have to love them because they don't understand what the absence of love does to the human soul." Those of us who are involved in this struggle know what that is, and therefore it seems to me it's incumbent upon us not to give up this fight, not to shrink from the truth, not to continue to be courageous, but whatever we do, to have as much love as we can, as much love and forgiveness as we can. Because, W.H. Auden said at the beginning of the Second World War, "We must love one another or die." It's kind of dramatic, but in a sense, I think it captures what the task is and the challenge before us. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I've had lots of people ask me if they should see this movie or not, and I have to say every time I watch it, it's an emotional roller coaster for me, just reliving everything that's been going on in the last several years, compacted into 90 minutes. It's really hard. And so when people ask me that, the first thing I say is, well, if you haven't heard of all the stuff that they're talking about, you're going to be shocked. You're going to be mad. You're going to be angry. You're going to be sad. You're going to need somebody to talk to afterwards. The other thing I tell them is that there are a lot of places where the movie has gone over the top, where there's some grasping and stretching for points that make it more of a propaganda piece than a real documentary BBC kind of a piece, which Bob has addressed very clearly. And so what I think I'll talk about here most is, what do you do with your energy after you've seen this movie and after you feel the anger and you go through the emotional roller coaster, and what do you do? I had a former bishop who asked me if he should see this movie, and I explained to him what was going on and told him a little bit about it. He says, "Well, I don't really like these movies that have like lots of fighting and contention." I said, "Well, you probably don't want to watch this one." But I told him that one reason that he might consider watching it is that there are a lot of people in the community who are watching it, and they are getting their information about Mormons, they're getting their information about homosexuals, they're getting their information about how we treat each other based on this movie, and they aren't necessarily applying critical thinking skills. They haven't read Dialogue, they haven't read Sunstone, they aren't familiar with reviews, and so we need to keep in mind that other people are seeing these things, and it would be good for us to maybe know what's there so that we know how to react to it. So one thing that I always think is really important is remember to put on your critical thinking hat. If you don't know what critical thinking skills are, go find some. It will help you in this movie, it will help you in your conversations everywhere. Second, don't be afraid to stand up by yourself. That even though you feel like you're the lone, tall blade of grass that's going to be chopped down, once you get your head over the crowd, you're going to see that there are other blades of grass that are sticking up. And when you're standing up and standing with integrity for what you really believe in, people do respect that. And if you're the only one speaking out, keep speaking out until somebody else joins you. For each person who's willing to speak out and able to speak out, there are dozens who cannot speak out, who, if they were to speak out, would put their jobs in jeopardy, would put their lives in jeopardy, would put their selves in jeopardy. And so if you are in a safe place, if you are in a network, if you have a network of support, speak out and tell the truth and say, you know, people need to be respected, and we cannot treat people poorly. We have a responsibility to support and love each other, and there is absolutely no reason whatsoever that we should let our dialogues fall into this demeaning, polemical, slippery slope arguments that say, I'm right, you're wrong, and God's on my side. That is just irresponsible. The most important thing that we can do is show respect. Even if the people on the other side are not being respectful, there's no reason to lower yourself to their level. If they're not standing with you, you know, they can go marry their cats in their own church, and the state isn't going to recognize their union. And it's not something that, it's just such a ridiculous argument that you don't need to engage it. But when you start with common ground and with bridge building, and you're not attacking people, it really helps. And if you can read what's been written about this movie and become familiar with some of the, there's a lot of stuff in the movie that deals with really hard issues, and there's lots of fact-finding places on the internet where you can find the answers and say, did this really happen? What's the context of this? If you know what the context is, you can share that with the people around you. So I know that we want to have lots of time for people to talk, so I'm going to hand this back to Hugo.
Thank you so much. Both Alice and Laura and Bob are wonderful examples of what Laura was just talking about. We have about 20 minutes for Q&A. Let's try to keep up our questions short and so that many people can participate.
Boy, that's a lot of stuff. I don't know where to begin. I mean, I saw the movie. The people, I know some of the people connected to it also, they wanted to interview Senator Hatch, Senator Bennett. When you decline, they could have done the cheap way and gone to some guy at Temple Square and yelled, and there's Mayor. These are two prominent people. Butters is a big feature here, and Gale's big all over the country. I think that was responsible to interview him. I don't think either one of you touched on the thing that really had me disturbed was the aversion therapy they did in the 70s. Now, even the San Francisco Chronicle said their main mistake was not to point out it isn't done now. They made it seem like it might have been done last week. But this is something that once Bill Maher and people get a hold of it, we're going to be toast. I mean, this is going to be a big class action suit. The ACLU will be interested in this. Is that people signed a waiver, and people could come in, and it's pretty gross stuff here. I'll just say, like, use stuff that the old Soviet Union would have brought up, shocking genitals, putting up images, see how people react to it. That's bad. The thing that really disturbed me, and again, I wish the makers of the movie were here, was the use of the little girl. That made me quit paying my tithing right then. We, along with the Knights of Columbus, funded an ad of a little girl going to a gay lesbian wedding in San Francisco. And the ad made it seem she was pulled out of public school. She was transferred on taxpayer buses. And Gavin Newsom performed this lesbian thing when she should have been learning the 3 R's. Nothing further from the truth. She's from Marin County. the 25 of the 27 parents agreed to go to that thing. They all carpooled. The thing where she's shivering, they got the 1 minute of the KPIX film where she's there, oh, girl shivering. The coat was in the other car, they got the coat on her, they got the hot chocolate, she got to witness the ceremony, go back to Marin County, ba-boom, end of story. And what it was portrayed as is that it was used on the internet. Several pedophiles tried to contact the school saying, who's that little Cindy that needs to be adopted, named her? It set us back a long time, and I've understood that Ballard and the Knights of Columbus tried to meet with the family. It's led to even more contention, beyond reprehensible, I think. And then the last thing is we funded it much like the tobacco companies. We had a tobacco tax in California 6 years ago. It had 2-1. And that $85 million comes from Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds saying this is a socialist Ralph Nader thing. It's going to repeal Prop 13. They're going to double your property tax. No one was talking about tobacco. They thought it was about property tax. The thing went down after being ahead 2-1. This thing would have sailed through. When we set up phony committees like Committees for Good Government and Responsible Families, no one knew where the money was coming from. The movie pointed that out very well. So could you guys address all these things?
Thank you. Does anyone have any comment or should we go?
Go to MormonsForMarriage.com. We have fact-checking on all that, including the story about the little girl. And yeah, there's lots of stuff that we haven't talked about here. There's lots in the movie.
Can you tell us, did Ballard meet with the family and did he just pretty much try to blame the Knights of Columbus for getting the footage from the APIX?
I'm not familiar with that part. I'd have to go and review our fact check on that.
At the Santa Cruz showing, the man in the movie who was subject to or was involved in the revulsion or reparative therapy. It was really, to me, a wonderful example of how a human being can recover dignity. He talks in very graphic terms about how hurtful that was for him. And the detail in the film is horrifying. But he was much more forgiving of that than most people are who see it. To me, it's not excusable, but I think that, again, somehow we have to stop shouting each other across a great chasm. And I think we can be grateful that the horrible things that happened at BYU during that period of time are, I can't vouch for this 100%, no longer happening, but I understand they aren't.
Michael.
This is my word, but it's... I've got a big voice.
Do you want to introduce this one?
Yeah, I think so.
I have reasons for believing that bishops did, in fact, assign a certain amount to the campaign. And the reason for that is because this is historically a pattern, not in political campaigns, but before I settled in one particular house with my family when I was on faculty at BYU, I had moved a lot, about 20 times in 10 years. And I was in a lot of wards, and typically my timing was such that they were always building either a state center or a temple in the wards that I moved into. And typically, and it was pretty standard that during, although it's no longer done now, this was a pattern that the bishop would say, based on the amount of tithing that you pay, this is what we think would be a reasonable percentage of the tithing you pay for your assessment for the building fund of the stake center or the temple or whatever. Well, that's no longer a pattern in church finance because those special drives for contributions are now taken care of by the headquarters of the church, as far as I know, that's still the case. But anyone with that background, either as a church leader or as a member of the church who was assessed in that way, would think it completely reasonable as a bishop to use that same formula or that same approach, maybe not the same percentage formula, but the same kind of approach when the prophet of the Lord has said it would be good for you to donate to this campaign. And so I'm sure that there were bishops who did, in fact, make that kind of assessment.
As a good historian, Michael, I think you would say we need to be careful extrapolating something that happened in terms of the church building program 20 or 30 years ago with what that happened now. I have not heard, and I don't know whether Laura does, of a single instance in which that kind of assessment was made. Now, it may be that there were some, but I think that it may not have been as general as some people say.
In the film, where that quote comes from the film, George Cole says that the bishop comes, here's how much money you need. If you don't pay this much money, you're going to get excommunicated. Or else, if you don't. He uses the word. I'm pretty sure he uses the word excommunicated. There were certainly, it's very clear that there were stake quotas, that each stake was to provide a certain amount of money. It's also very clear that there were people in individual wards who were contacted specifically to donate five figure donations at the behest of the leadership of LDS leaderships. There were special conference calls that were created in order to encourage people to donate that money. It's very clear that there were financial goals and that people were asked. Now, I don't know if, you know, there's one blog post that says that the guy came in and the bishop said, write a check, and they were shocked about how much money, and they had to choose whether they should write that money or pay the down payment on the house, and they wrote the money, but they got the house anyway, and it was a real faith-promoting event for them. But at the same time, you know, I don't, my bishop, I know they didn't come to me. Well, they knew how I felt about it. I don't know that, it wouldn't surprise me if it happened.
I don't know of a single example.
Okay, but I don't think that they would execute. I don't think anybody said we're going to excommunicate you.
No, it was frowned upon. The words are usually frowned upon, and it might come.
But and also, I've been keeping really close track of this, and I don't know any person who has been excommunicated for not donating money. There's been other things that have happened, but there's nobody that has been excommunicated that I know of.
Thank you, Laura. That was the one point that I wanted to complete.
Yeah. I think that it would be valuable to share the effect or the impact of Eighth Amendment Proposition 8 campaign in Rochester, New York, where I'm from. I'm a gay member and I'm active in the church. And because of the activity that was going on in California, I was called by, number one, my best friend from BYU years, who happens to be an internationally well-known science fiction writer, who is very homophobic. You might be able to figure out who called me. But he and I broke off a 4-year friendship because that we have repaired since then, but that ended the friendship. Also, my best friend from high school called me from California to ask us to give them a donation. This is, we live in New York. My wife, yeah, I'm married. My wife happened to answer the phone and apparently gave him peace of her mind that he still hasn't recovered from. We still haven't made up. But what it did to me personally as a professional is I had been quietly working on a Gay Mormon literature project for quite a few years, and I decided to finish that. We started that and announced it and presented on it last year here at Sunstone, and we are again this year, 2 sessions tomorrow. After that, the Proposition 8 campaign affected my work as an artist. And I chose to do the play Equus because one of the main themes is what happens to a person when their faith is ripped from them. And becoming a little more open in my own community, and then my state president called me. And, you know, you're kind of nervous when you get that kind of a call when you've decided to be a little more open and such. And he called me to serve on that council. And my first assignment was to do a fireside with him on homosexuality and Mormonism. And we did a production of Carolyn Pearson's Facing East. We did a Equity Showcase production in Rochester. And the church came as a fireside. We had standing room only, and the state president and I did a fireside afterward for the members. Last Sunday, I was called to go down to meet with three Mormon counselors who work at Attica, one of them in the sex offenders area, because Proposition 8 had affected the inmates so negatively at Attica, both the inmates and the other counselors, that they needed to discuss what they could do personally. And all we could say is the movie is what it is. It reports what happened. The church made terrible mistakes. A member of our area presidency came to our fireside and stood up and said, the church made terrible mistakes that are recorded in the film, Eighth Mormon Proposition, and they are paying for it and will be paying for it for years. In fact, the church has officially changed the way they deal with PR and with people and political people's ability to invoke the name of the church in their politics. And just last week, in our area anyhow, bishops got a letter from the First Presidency instructing them how to handle court cases and trials in relation to testifying and such, in specifically politically hot trials and such, especially related to things like homosexuality. So okay, my time's over. So there has been some incredible positive results from Eighth Mormon Proposition. I just thought they needed to be reported.
Thank you, Jerry. We have 7 minutes left. I don't know how many more questions. This works higher volume, louder volume than that one, so if you want to use it.
Let's try to be short to the point.
I went to high school and junior high school and whatnot with Tyler Barrick, and I am gay, and actually a few people that I went to school with in that class and other classes are also gay, and we had a tiny, tiny school, so there must have been something in the water, because quite a few of us ended up gay, and it was this tiny Mormon town, but amazingly, at our school, people were incredibly supportive of us, and I mean, more supportive than my family ever was. I had this very supportive school environment, and I was so touched when the court case closed the other day, and I was on Facebook, and I had a friend write to Tyler and say how happy she was for him. And when those of us in the community here marched around downtown and we saw this couple by Temple Square who had just gotten married, and we waved at them and they waved back at us, and we were all smiling at each other, and it was friendly. And I'm so happy that there are these good Mormon people who, even though we have our differences, still love us. And even though I was angry at the church for a while around the time of Prop 8, I'm so glad that I know that there are Mormons who support us. And I guess I don't really have a question. I just want to say how happy I am that I know that there are those of you here.
Thank you. Maybe.
I'll try to be real quick. In case any of you don't know, I'm Laura's mother, and my website, Mormons for Aid, tracked the Mormon money. The website went up just about 2 years ago. It was right after Sunstone, and that's when we started putting it all together, and downloaded the names of the donors from the Secretary of State website and used various means to figure out which ones were Mormons. Soon after we got the website up publicly, we started having just a ton of donations come in that were five figures, the dominant number being 25,000, some were 10, 15. At about the same time, word started going up on some websites saying that there had been a conference call to wealthy donors asking them to give a large amount of money. We didn't know how much. Very soon after that, I was contacted by a reporter from the Wall Street Journal, And he tracked down, I told him about this pattern of giving, and he tracked down the donors, at least one of the donors who went on record, confirmed that the conference call took place and that they were asked to give $25,000. I can only assume that they knew who those wealthy donors were by looking at the tithing contributions.
Thank you. Thank you, Nadine, for all your activism and support. You have been amazing. Yes, and I think we have two more minutes. Do we? Yeah. Yeah? Fine. Okay. Do you want to use this mic? Ron.
I just have a quiet comment. It struck me that we were being too defensive. Instead of saying, this is an absolute travesty. Something that brings shame that it happened. And I think it's possible to be too defensive, and that is when sectarianism dominates. We're really concerned with justice. And surely that's what we stand for.
Thank you. Do we have one more?
I saw the film, and I agree with a lot of what Robert Reese said. If you're on one side of the fence, you'll love the movie, and on the other side, you'll hate it. But for those who are in the middle, I kind of thought maybe, I don't want to know what the panel thinks about this, that it was almost counterproductive going after, the church was contributing to the campaign, but in the end, it's the California voter, most of which are Mormons, who struck down gay marriage. It wasn't the church that struck it down. And so it almost seemed that they were scapegoating these people for doing it, blaming it on them. And it almost came off as they're sore losers to me. I mean, everyone who loses a campaign complaints, calls foul, if they would have won the line, I mean, they all do that. So I know they're going to do that. But making films and kind of throwing in some of the stuff that Reese was talking about, like the threatening excommunications, it just came off to me as maybe counterproductive for those who were maybe more centered on the whole issue than on one side or the other.
Thank you for your comment. One more?
Just with respect to Michael's comment about evidentiary donations, minimum requirements by the wards and stakes, and your comment with respect to plausible evidence for asking for specific amounts. Okay. Father is active LDS and provided me the specific amounts that his ward was requiring. I have two employees, both in different stakes, both in bishoprics, and provided me the specific amounts that they were, or targets, or quotas that they were trying to achieve. So I just wanted to provide further evidence of that type of behavior.
Do you know what the targets were?
Several hundred thousand.
My point was that there were not quotas, or that there were not specific requests. My concern was the impression that this was very coercive, and that if people didn't make these contributions, there would be consequences. It may be that happened. I just need the evidence. I've not heard anything that gives evidence of a bishop sitting down and suggesting that this is the amount that you pay, and if you don't, beware. And so I think that was the point that I was trying to make.
You have 30 seconds.
This is a repeat of Prop 22, which occurred in the year 2000. And I heard from a number of straight married couples in California that they were told by their bishops that there was a certain amount the Lord was supposed to provide. This is in the year 2000. And they were asked if they could give the certain amount. And the minimums that I was being told by married couples was they were being asked to provide 500. Some of them were asked to donate 2,000. So in the Prop 22 campaign, I don't see a difference. Even if you don't have the evidence by now in this campaign, it was going on in 2000.
Thank you everyone for this amazing session.